Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
Jose Bautista back with the Toronto Blue Jays, and we will discuss it on At the Letters. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, and I will not be joined by Arden Zwelling this week because he has pneumonia. Get well soon, Arden. Hopefully you'll be back here very soon. But I do have a couple of guests joining me this week. Shai Davidi will be here in studio to discuss the deal, how it relates to the Blue Jays, and really look at everything to do with this Toronto Blue Jays team that is finally taking shape. And then we'll get a bit of a national perspective from Dave Cameron of Fangraphs, who always has great insight on free agency, team construction. So we'll pick Dave's brain on Bautista and the Blue Jays as well. Coming up next on At the Letters.
Bautista high and deep to left. Stay there, bro. Stay fair. It is gone. You can always go back to the big guys to come up with big hits in tough situations.
Here's the 0-1. That is hit down the line and left. Into the corner, and this game is tied. It's a 3-3 game here in the eighth inning. And Bautista's got two tonight. And he finally breaks through with the long ball here in this ALCS two times. And it's 3-3.
The 1-1 pitch.
Fly ball deep left field. Yes, sir. There she goes.
Jose Bautista is unbelievable. Great players tend to rise in huge situations. What a moment for Jose Bautista and his club. He's been here for a long time now, finally getting to the postseason. And what better guy to step up in that situation?
Welcome back to At the Letters and joined by Shai Davidi in studio. Shai, how's it going?
All right, Ben. Busy times.
I know, seriously. So, I mean, just to start off here, this, I think, compared to where we were a few months ago, compared to where we were a year ago, was a pretty big surprise. So, I mean, what's your reaction to seeing this deal happen?
Surprise.
Yeah.
You know, this, if you think about all the different things that we've heard, and you and I talked to a lot of the same people all throughout the offseason, this didn't seem to be something that was in the cards. And you contrast it with the way the Blue Jays aggressively pursued Encarnacion and Cecil and then Morales and Pierce, and the way they scoured the trade market, this obviously wasn't their preferred alternative. But it got to the point where it just made too much sense for them. On the flip side with Jose Bautista, his priority, his desire was always to get back here, and he didn't find anything that to tempt him away from here. And so you get this this sort of bizarre, unusual sort of homecoming where it's not so much a marriage of love, but in a lot of ways, a marriage of convenience.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not necessarily the best case scenario for either side. But then if you're the team and it's 18 and a half, if that is where the guarantee ends up, I mean, that's just a really good deal for a player of his caliber, right?
Sure. And, you know, just because it's the ideal circumstances aren't going in doesn't mean that it's not going to work out, right? Because the last year really skewed the perception on Jose Bautista. And people who think that he's just going to completely collapse, I don't see that. And, you know, some evaluators that I tend to trust that I've spoken to in the industry really think he's going to hit. Now, where he's at defensively, that's in question. But I don't think that, if healthy, that he's going to have, there should be much doubt that he's going to perform better offensively than he did last year.
Yeah. One person I asked, you know, just to kind of ballpark project what Bautista would hit next year, and they said low average, high on base, and probably 30 home runs. That sounds kind of about right for a player who's definitely aging. He's not going to beat out many infield singles. He's probably not going to stretch out as many singles into doubles anymore, but he can still hit the ball really hard.
Right, and that plate discipline won't erode, right? And that's always going to give him a chance. Does he maybe have to cheat on the fastball for some of the high velo guys a little bit more? Perhaps. But, you know, he's still going to give you a high quality at bat. He's going to be a very tough out, and he's going to be able to create offense for you one way or another.
What about the draft pick? Because that was a big discussion, and I honestly thought that the Jays really valued the pick more than Bautista, and I know that some people in the industry just really expected that the Blue Jays would prefer to take that draft pick. So, I mean, how did we get to the point where now they're willing to walk away. I mean, they're not technically losing a pick, but they're losing the opportunity to get a pick.
Right. And I think there are a couple things at play there. One, what happens if Batista lingers on the market and, you know, maybe he signs with a bottom 10 team that, you know, gets you a second round pick as opposed to a first round pick. And maybe that's a bit less appealing at that point, because now you're into, you know, the 60s or 70s with the pick as opposed to being in the 30s. And, you know, that changes the value. On the flip side too, you know, a team like the Blue Jays has to measure the value of that pick against the value of capitalizing on a competitive window. And if you're going to go with a lesser player for 2017, when you legitimately have a chance to be a wild card, like, you know, the Boston Red Sox are in all likelihood going to win the division. I think a lot of things have to go significantly wrong for that not to happen.
Yeah.
But the wild card is there for the taking. And so are you going to punt on that in order to get a draft pick who may, if things fall right, help you in 4 or 5 years? You know, that's a value proposition that's really difficult to stomach. So I would have agreed with you, but I think the value of that pick decreased as the alternatives to Jose Bautista, the quality of the alternatives to Jose Bautista decreased.
Yeah, and it seems like a move for the present. I mean, this is definitely on a one-year deal. Who knows what happens with the options beyond 2017, but this is a player who's designed to help this team now, and then you look at the pick, that would have been a move to help the team in future seasons. So in a sense, I think we'd all gotten to the point where we're almost expecting the Blue Jays to make all these future focused moves, and this is a move that seems very focused on 2017.
Oh yeah, 100%. And you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that in a lot of ways, if the options don't get exercised, is that this asset dies at the end of the year, right? Because there's no draft pick compensation at the end of the year if he walks, because he was qualified once, he can't be qualified again under the new system. And as a 10-5 guy, it's not like if the Blue Jays collapse that they can just go and trade him at the deadline. He would control that process. So, you know, this contract essentially includes a no trade because of that 10-5 status. So, I mean, it very much is, this is in a lot of ways, the end of the control with Jose Bautista.
So you mentioned earlier the industry reaction to this deal, and I'm interested because I know that you've talked to a bunch of people since the deal it's not official yet, but it certainly seems as if it's heading in that direction. So what are some of the reactions that you've heard from people in the game to this contract?
Well, you know, I would say most of the reaction is like, it's a pretty good salvage job for him to end up beating the qualifying offer and the guarantee. And most people are looking at the mutual options as window dressing on the contract and not really anything of substance. But, you know, there are some criticisms of him for ending up in this spot and for being in a situation where he might have been able to get a multi-year deal at some point. Now, part of that is market related. Part of that is related to the injuries and the lack of normal production from him last season. But there are some in the industry who are like, well, you know, he overplayed his hand. It didn't work out for him, and now he has to settle for this. And I think from some of the player agent community, everybody wants the other players to do well, because, you know, anything that sort of, every contract helps subsequent players do better. So I think there was some pretty interesting reaction to it. And I think at this point, though, you know, Jose Bautista has a lot of things to prove to a lot of people. He's obviously going to be motivated to do that. How important that is, I'm not sure. But it's going to be very interesting to watch him next season.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can't motivate your way through a turf toe injury. You know, if something like that were to arise, mm-hmm. again, there are some things where you can be as motivated and as fit as you want to be, and it's still not going to help you. So, you know, it's interesting with a guy who's 36 years old, how much that is going to help him. But I still think, and I think that a lot of people look at it this way, that Bautista has the potential to be a big bargain for this team on sure. $18.5
million. 100%. You know, here's an interesting thing too, Ben, is like, just think about the discussion we were having at the beginning of spring training last year, or going into that, where you would have said, Jose Bautista is the player you want to extend, but Edwin Encarnacion is the player you likely have a better chance of re-signing.
Yeah.
Right? And so we go through the season, that perception completely flips, and you end up in the offseason that the Blue Jays end up whiffing on Edwin Encarnacion, and they get Jose Bautista back, but it really feels like they're settling right now. I mean, because in a lot of ways they are settling, but a year ago, this is exactly what you would have wanted. And it's really strange to look at it in that way.
Yeah, it really is. Because so much, I guess with Encarnacion, the perception of him was pretty consistent. He's that always been that steady player for the Jays. But the perception around Bautista has changed a lot in the last 18 months and definitely in the last year. Just as far as his interactions with other teams and the injuries that he dealt with, the production that was still good, but it wasn't Jose Bautista good. So yeah, I think in a lot of ways we ended up with a big reversal, and it feels weird. I mean, that's something you wrote about in your piece on sportsnet.ca, but this is going to be an interesting one to see how this team and how Bautista frames this whole reunion.
Sure. I mean, it's really amazing. Like, just think like that an executive, Dan Duquette, actually said, we can't sign this guy because our fans won't like him. Like, I mean, I can't remember another similar example.
Well, and John Daniels, the Rangers GM, didn't have to say that. It was understood. Everyone knew that there was no chance that he was going to go to Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, you know, maybe a more outspoken GM than Daniels probably would have gone out there and said something along those lines.
Sure.
But nobody would even contemplate the possibility of Bautista signing there. So that's two teams, and throw in Cleveland, potentially.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because these are teams in their competitive window trying to win. And on the field, there's no debate. Jose Bautista helps you win.
Yeah.
Like, Jose Bautista is an upgrade. Flaws and all, is an upgrade for almost every team in at one outfield spot.
Yeah. I mean, Baltimore needs a right fielder right now.
Right. You know, and they ran Trumbo out there at times last year. So, you know, they can't be crying, oh, we can't surrender the defense, because, you know, I'd rather have Bautista by far in right field than Trumbo.
And Nelson Cruz before that, and right. Pedro Alvarez. That's not a very defensive team, yeah. in the corners, at least.
Yeah, they've punted defense there for some offense, without a doubt. Tremendous infield defense, yeah. But that's another discussion. So, the whole thing is very intriguing, and I think Jose Bautista got caught up in that to some degree. He got caught in the, as we wrote about a few weeks ago, the sort of changing valuation of players with home runs. A very, very odd free agent class as well. And this is certainly not how I think anybody would have scripted this offseason.
Yeah, not even the Blue Jays. No. I mean, you know, as far as any GM can script an offseason, Ross Atkins at the beginning of the winter said that he, all things being equal, and he wasn't hell-bent on making this happen, but he wanted ideally to get more left-handed, to get a little bit younger, a little bit more athletic. Since then, they've signed three players, none of whom is younger than 30, and two of whom are right-handed hitters. So this is an unexpected path for the team as well.
Sure, and, you know, people have to give the Blue Jays a pass on the younger thing, because unless you're going to completely pillage your farm system, you aren't getting younger through trade, right? The only real way you're getting younger is by promoting and developing your own players. And so the Blue Jays aren't there yet. Some guys are starting to get close to helping turn over the core, perhaps, but they're not there. That's going to take some time. The left-handed thing is interesting because, I mean, they had one regular left-hander last year in Michael Saunders. And this year, they're going to have Kendrys Morales as a switch hitter. But at least Morales is going to hit in the middle of your lineup.
Yep.
So now you're forcing the opposing manager to make some sort of decisions with his bullpen late in games. And that could have a positive effect. So I think that's a big gain. But if you look at the roster, they're not faster. I think you can make the case they're less athletic with Pierce and Morales than they were with Encarnacion and Saunders. So they're not going to be creating offense all of a sudden. They're still going to be a team reliant on slug, reliant on home runs, that's going to need three or four hits in an inning to score a guy if they're not going deep.
So defensively, Do you think that Batista is going to be exclusively a right fielder? Could we see him at first base? I mean, how do you think these pieces fit together?
That's a great question. And I think if you look at it just based strictly on need, I don't see how you're not playing Batista in right field.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think as things shape up right now, you're talking about Batista in right, Pilar in center, and a three-headed monster in left of Carrera, Upton, and Pierce in some way, shape, or form. Now, Pierce may end up playing a lot more at first base if Justin Smoke struggles the way he did in the second half last season, is a complete non-factor offensively. I don't think this Blue Jay team can afford that. And as good as he is defensively, I don't think, you know, you can't just carry a guy for defense at first base. Yeah. And have him be a black hole offensively. So I think there's some flux there. But as presently constituted, that's how I would see it. But, you know, would you prefer, you know, I mean, is it preferable for the Blue Jays to have, you know, maybe Batista more at first base and you go get someone like an Angel Pagan to participate in some of the outfield, and then you've got a creative type top of the lineup type of hitter who will walk and get on base and allow you to maybe create some offense that way? I mean, that's an interesting question, but I think right now that's the way. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that Batista should probably bring a first base glove to spring training, keep the options open. I see there's no real downside there. And if he wants to contribute defensively a bit more, that versatility might help. I mean, that being said, who plays right field then, right? So maybe Melvin Upton has a bounce back here. So maybe you go with Batista, Pierce, and Upton on certain days in the outfield and first base. I mean, that's one possibility. I mean, Zeke, I think, is probably best suited as a bench guy. Mm-hmm. I think we saw that last year. Pompey, I would assume, is going to AAA.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know exactly how the pieces fit, only that, you know, with injuries and everything that can come up in the course of a season, probably helps if Batista is comfortable at first base.
Sure. No, without doubt. And what's interesting is that the way things are set up, and I don't think this is by design, but a spot on the team isn't blocked to Dalton Pompey. And if he puts it together and forces their hand, I mean, you're not going to keep him off the, you know, a platoon of Upton Carrera isn't preventing Dalton Pompey from winning a job or forcing his way into the conversation, because, you know, both those guys are making negligible sums. The Upton hit for next year, the portion the Blue Jays are paying is $1 million. Carrera's just 1.1 and change. So that position isn't blocked. And, you know, Dalton Pompey's skill set is so perfect for this team. So much of what they need. And the talent and the ability is there. But, it, you know, will he convince them that he is deserving of that opportunity?
Yeah, I think that if he shows well defensively in spring training, that would go a long way toward mm-hmm. really winning some people over with the Blue Jays. Because, you know, you look at the description of the type of player that the Blue Jays might want. Well, he's a switch hitter, so you have the platoon advantage more. He's younger. He, in theory, could be a better defender, although we haven't seen that yet. So I think that might be the piece where if he goes out there, and, you know, not that he has to be Brett Gardner in left field, but if he goes out there and he can just hold his own, make the routine plays, cover a lot of ground, then that might be enough to really get a nice, long, hard look.
Right. And again, if they go into the season too, if he keeps on pushing at Buffalo and show, one of the things they're looking for him is consistency, a focus, and a consistency in not necessarily the results, but in just the approach on the field. If he continues to show that in Buffalo and Carrera and Upton are middling along, that's an easy adjustment to make midseason.
Yeah, for sure. So offensively, this team against left-handed pitching looks really good. You have Pierce, lefty masher. You have Upton, lefty masher. And then even guys like Tulo and Martin, Batista, you have a lot of right-handed, Josh Donaldson, of course. You've got a team that should really hit left-handed pitching. That bodes well against the Red Sox. But that's still only going to represent, you know, what, 20% of pitchers that you face mm-hmm. in the course of a season. And against right-handed pitching, this lineup doesn't look as strong. So, you know, do you think there's any chance they go out there and try to add a left-handed hitting outfielder for that left field spot? Or are the resources more likely to go to lefty relief, backup catcher?
It's a great concern and a great point you make, and that thought process on the vulnerability to the right-handed pitchers, particularly right-handed pitchers with some sink and some a good slider, which we saw oftentimes last season, it's an important consideration. My sense is that they feel Morales in the middle of the lineup helps in a way that Saunders a little bit lower down doesn't. And, you know, if you look at it last year, when Saunders was hitting in the first half and he was sort of batting fourth, fifth in that area, times six, you know, that the Blue Jays seemed a little bit less vulnerable or less susceptible to those type of pitchers. So if Morales is able to really be productive in the middle of that lineup and provide a little bit of leeway for Donaldson and Tulowitzki and perhaps Bautista, depending how they structure the lineup, you know, I think that may be a little bit of a gain over last year, but that still has to play out. On the flip side, if you're looking at this roster right now and you're saying, what do we really, really need? The lack of a left-hander is just so blaring and out
it's
there.
Huge.
It sticks out.
Oh yeah.
So I think that's where the money has to go. And I think, you know, I think Jerry Blevins is certainly on their radar. You know, Travis Wood is really interesting, but he wants to be a starter, from what I understand. And I think he wants to exhaust that before he returns to serve as a reliever again, but he completely negated lefties last year for the Cubs. I think it was a 420 or 430 OPS against lefties and 120 plate appearances. So that'll play.
Yeah.
But I think that's where you have to spend your money right now. So I think that's probably where you're going to get the most impact at this point. I mean, you know, if you bring in a Brandon Moss, for example, I mean, how much is he going to play? Is he going to make enough of a difference versus not having a lefty?
Yeah, and you wonder what kind of dollars Brandon Moss ends up with. I mean, maybe the Michael Saunders deal, $9 million. I mean, is that a point of reference for Brandon Moss? Probably. I would think he slots in a little lower even.
Yeah, I would think lower because of the way, I mean, Michael Saunders had a terrible finish to the season, and, you know, Michael Saunders, you could say teams could have health concerns just the way they do with Brandon Moss. The one thing that may be working against Moss is that, you know, the music's going to stop soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, the chairs are running out.
Yeah, and you've got guys like Pedro Alvarez and Adam Lind and Justin Morneau. Like, you have left-handed bats who would be available presumably for even less money, so you have that upward pressure too if you're Brandon Moss.
Right, and this is where, and this point has been debated ad nauseum, so I don't want to sort of go down that rabbit hole, but, you know, the re-signing of Justin Smoak sort of tied your hands, and, like, you could have picked and choose from whoever's still out there, and maybe found someone who's a better offensive option. Now, I understand the Blue Jays wanted the security and the protection of having Smoak under contract. They like his defense. They like the fit in the clubhouse, all those things, and those things matter. But, you know, you'd certainly, right now, there are some left-handed bats out there that would be pretty interesting, you know, on a roll of the dice type of setting that wouldn't necessarily entail an $8 million guarantee over 2 years and maybe give you a chance at a bit more production from the left side.
Yeah, I think you could say similar things about another switch-hitting DH first base type that the Blue Jays signed in 2016.
Right.
And Kendrys Morales.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's done is done. I mean, when you look at the overall offseason and the direction they're taking, you can see the team starting to take shape. And right now, I think that the left-handed reliever is probably the biggest need. So, I'm going to be looking to see if they do end up with someone like a Jerry Blevins, because if they do, then all of a sudden you're a backup catcher away from potentially having a pretty good team.
Sure. And, you know, a rival executive I was speaking to the other day just said, you know, if they stretch out Biagini, that bullpen is scary thin. That was the term that was used, scary thin. And I think that's a fair point, but if they go down, if a starter happens to go down, that, you know, they've got no real options. I mean, do you really want to see Brett Oberholzer making a handful of starts?
Bolsinger.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's not an appealing list of options. And Bolsinger probably makes this team because he's out of options right now, unless he gets completely bombed during spring training and they're convinced they can sneak him through waivers. But, you know, he's out of options. He's probably on this team in some way, shape, or form. I mean, Glenn Sparkman, the Rule 5 pick, you know, the Blue Jays are obviously going to give him every chance to make the team. And this bullpen construction is going to be very, very interesting.
Yeah, and as much as they did a phenomenal job last year of adjusting on the fly, expecting to do that 2 years in a row, to me, seems really ambitious.
Right. I mean, a lot of teams try to adjust their bullpen on the fly and not with the success. And look, credit to the Blue Jays, man.
Yeah.
They were right on Grilly. They were right on Benoit. But that's, if that's your fallback plan, and look, sometimes necessity means that has to be your fallback plan. But, I mean, they have some interesting bullpen guys. You know, is Tapera able to take a step forward? Is Danny Barnes going to be a little bit more consistent and really, if he's able to replicate anything near what he did in the minors last year? I mean, that's a find. You know, is Matt Dermody ready to emerge as a power lefty, or does he still need more time? Does Chad Girardeau and his self-described 80 poo stuff, can he find a way to make that play?
Wow.
Look, I think that there are some interesting possibilities, and you know, I think the Blue Jays are definitely going to be in a situation where they go into spring training trying to figure out, hey, let's throw all this stuff against the wall, see what sticks. But I think everybody will feel a lot better if, you know, there's an established lefty like a Blevins or something along those lines, that at least they can know, all right, we give the ball to this guy in the seventh or eighth inning in a leverage AB, we know what we're going to get.
Exactly. The Chris Davis matchup. I mean, you got to have someone there.
Right. And, yeah. You know, Jackie Bradley Jr.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just, you know, turning around a guy. That's not where you want to lose your ball games.
For sure. We've seen a lot of that, and I'm sure John Gibbons is hoping as much as anyone that they add someone.
Yeah. I would sort of, and you know, the interesting kind of debate, just to circle back to Jose for a second, is just, you know, given the way the Blue Jays are put together right now, is spending the money on going big on Jose and then maybe skimping on other areas the right approach versus spreading that wealth around and addressing a bunch of needs? I mean, we haven't talked about backup catcher yet, but if you're going into the season with AJ Jimenez and nothing else at backup, I mean, you are dangerously exposed in the event of an injury to Team Canada shortstop Russell Martin.
Yeah, that's a really bad idea. I mean, they're going to add someone, right? There's no way they go in with AJ Jimenez.
Yeah, I mean, like, Kurt Suzuki's out there.
Yeah.
You know,
Brian Pena.
Yeah, and Brian Pena, you would think, is not a major commitment at this point.
Minor league deal, maybe.
Yeah. If it is a major league guarantee, it's for sure under $1 million, you know?
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah.
So, it could be Dion or Navarro. I mean, you can still do reasonably well right now.
Yeah.
I think they will. And the Chris Iannetta signing, I thought, was really interesting that he only got $1.5 million, you know, from Arizona. If that's the price on Iannetta, you know, Kurt Suzuki can't ask for much more. Gianna Navarro can't ask for much more.
Yeah.
And so they're able to sneak. They should be able to sneak in, you know, a reasonable backup at a reasonable sum. The question is, how much will that eat away from the money they have left to spend on a lefty? And, you know, in an ideal world, on another outfielder.
Yeah, just no bad contracts out there these days when it comes to catchers or really anywhere else. And, you know, along those lines, you look at Batista signing for 18, Saunders signing for 9, Brett Cecil signed for 30.5, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So more than both those two guys combined. I mean, that to me is just crazy. Not that I think the Cecil deal is going to backfire at all. I think it'll be a good deal for St. Louis. But it's a weird market where a lefty reliever who started the season so poorly, losing as many games as the Cubs in April, ends up signing for more than these two established sluggers combined.
Absolutely. And I mean, just to your point, like, just think about how bad that April was for Brett Cecil. I mean, it was in terms of losses, it was like historically bad.
Yeah.
And then this was a prop bet in Vegas. Like, you would have made a fortune if you were able to pick this one out. So yeah, it is, but I also think it speaks to the supply and demand and sort of where this free agent market was, where it was teams wanted to load up on top end relievers.
Yeah.
And Brett Cecil was identified as the top non-Aroldis Chapman lefty out there. So, you know, the salary ended up matching the supply. And like, I think there's a significant drop off from Brett Cecil to the other relievers from a financial perspective. We've really seen that as well, in terms of have that pecking order being established. And, you know, the big time arms out of the bullpen got paid and everyone else didn't. And there's still a ton of relievers out there that probably help somebody that are still out there waiting for deals. So it has been a strange market in so many different ways.
So before we let you go, I want to get your sense on the division. And, you know, you alluded to it earlier. The Red Sox are rightly going to be the favorites entering this season. Where do you see the Jays fitting in the East? Where do you see them fitting in that wild card race? What's their outlook at this point?
Well, you know, handicapping it now based on the way the thing, I'd have a tough time saying that being convinced that the Blue Jays aren't the second best team in the division. Pretty clearly. I mean,
yeah.
We'll wait to see what the Orioles do.
Right. They'll probably grab some slugger late in the game.
Right.
I would assume.
But as presently constituted, I would certainly take the Blue Jays roster over the Orioles roster. Certainly take the Blue Jays roster over the Yankees roster.
Yep.
For present day. I mean, the Yankees are, who knows what the Yankees are? There's just so much youth there everywhere. I mean, if Aaron Judge figures it out, if Bird comes back healthy and is productive, then their outlook is a lot different. But I mean, there are a lot of ifs all around that.
The rotation alone. I mean, right. When you compare the Jays rotation to the Yankees rotation, I think that Toronto should be, you know, much, much better.
Right. But the Yankees have a lot of young options. And so I think the Yankees are, I think they're really hard to handicap right now. And, you know, they can certainly go either way. And the Rays are weird, you know, like they traded Drew Smyly and
Goldie.
Right. And they're just sort of, I don't know what they are. Like they're neither in, they're neither out. And which is unusual for the Rays because they're a little bit more decisive in what they want to do when they make a decision. So, I mean, they've still got a great pitching staff, which is going to be a pain in the ass for the teams in the division. They're going to hit some home runs, and Colby at the Trop is going to be fun.
It's going to be great.
But I just don't see how the Blue Jays aren't the second best team in the division. And then, you know, within the American League, I think you look at the Central, that clearly is Cleveland's to lose by a very wide margin.
Yeah.
Maybe Detroit still has enough there to hang around in the wild card and make some noise, but I don't foresee any of the Central teams factoring in the wild card race. And then you've got kind of three interesting teams in the AL West with Houston, Texas and Seattle. Yep. So, you know, I think that's the group that ends up competing for the wild card with the Blue Jays.
And they get to beat up on Oakland and the Angels too.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the Angels aren't so bad, but the A's don't look good at all.
No. I mean, there's another team that what are they doing? They're sort of stuck in no man's land. They make this late aborted run at Edwin Encarnacion for some reason, and
yep.
They're hard to read. So, yep. I know that's where I see things. I mean, what are you thinking right now?
Yeah, I think the Jays look like a wild card team. Like I think that you never know with a wild card because it all comes down to, as we saw last year, it comes down to the final weekend of the season and who knows what can happen in the course of a few games. But I think that they look like a team that should finish in the high 80s. And, you know, there's plus or minus there. If you have Aaron Sanchez miss time with a quad tear or Josh Donaldson, you know, breaks a forearm, then you're in trouble. But you know, otherwise, I think this team looks really good, and I don't expect them to compete with the Red Sox for the division in the end. I think Boston is too deep. They're too talented when it comes to their position players. Chris Sale, David Price, I mean, Rick Porcello, who won the Cy Young, that's a great rotation.
Steven Wright, all-star.
Yeah, I mean, right, and Drew Pomeranz was an all-star last year, too, and he might not even make the rotation. So, I mean, this is a deep, deep team. I think that they're easily the favorites. The Jays aren't as good, but as we saw last year, you can be a wild card team and still play baseball longer than the Red Sox.
Yeah, 100%. So it is. I think this year has the has a lot more potential for surprises all across the board, all across the league, maybe a bit more than last year. I think last year the quality teams were a little bit more defined than this year, and there you have a lot more teams in the American League who are pulling back right now than you have in previous years. You know, so I think over the course of the year there might be more players available for acquisition this year than there were last year.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Shai. This has been good.
It's always a pleasure.
All righty. There it is. Shai Davidi. Follow him on Twitter at Shai Davidi. And we will be back after this on At the Letters.
There's a drive. Deep left field. Back toward that wall. And it's gone. 3-1 pitch did a really good swing at the 3-0. Pulled it foul. He got his timing a little bit better.
Jose Bautista is a free agent at the end of the year. That's his first salvo. I'd like to stay.
We are back on At the Letters and really happy to be joined by Dave Cameron of Fangraphs. Dave, thanks for making the time. How's it going?
It's going well, although if I was in Toronto and I was a Blue Jays fan with the re-signing of Jose Bautista, I'd probably be doing a little better today.
Yeah. So what do you make of this signing, which just became official a couple minutes ago? $18.5 million guaranteed for Bautista on a deal that a lot of people didn't see coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're the Blue Jays, this is a dream scenario. Like, it was almost impossible to imagine, what was in March when the reports came out that he was asking for $150 million over 5 years, that 6 months later you'd get him back in a one-year deal for $18.5 million, and that didn't involve a scenario where he had, like, the plague or something. Like, yeah. he didn't, basically spend the entire year in the hospital. Like, Bautista, you know, he wasn't his normal self last year. He did have a down year. But his down year was still better than almost every other player on the free agent market. His down year was as good as Mark Trumbo's career year. And, I think to get a guy like this, who's still an impact player, who still can hit, on a one-year deal, $18 million, this means he's making Jeremy Hellickson money. Because Jeremy Hellickson took the qualifying offer. They're basically going to be paid the same amount of money next year. That's a crazy steal for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, it definitely has that potential. And, you know, you look at the Zips projections, which you guys have on Fangraphs, he's projected for something like a 373 weighted on base, which would be right essentially what Edwin Encarnacion did last year.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea that Bautista, you know, is over the hill and, you know, we've seen the last of the good Jose Bautista, it's just not really supported by evidence. I think Tom Tango, who works for Major League Baseball now and is doing a lot of the interesting StatCast work, has put out a kind of a graphic, and based on kind of Batista's hard hit rates and contact rates and launch angles and exit velocities and tracking kind of the ball off the bat, they expected that his kind of weighted on base average on contact, so when he doesn't swing and miss, was basically the same last year as it was in 2015. So essentially he got a little bit unlucky, or maybe got a little bit slower, but generally we're looking at kind of the data that says that Bautista is basically the same kind of hitter he was the year before, and the year before he wanted $150 million. Now, he shouldn't have gotten $150 million. That request was crazy. But I think we were talking in the spring. I thought, you know, something like $480 would have been a reasonable contract for the Blue Jays to give him, kind of based on where he was in his aging curve, and you know, kind of like with the expectation that this guy is not going to play forever. But you could justify $20 million a year for 3 or 4 years to get him for $20 million on 1 year. Basically takes away all the risk and still gives you the short-term boost. I don't think Jose Bautista is going to be the best hitter in baseball again anytime soon, but this is still an above-average power hitter signed for a way below-market contract.
And yet, there were 29 other teams that could have potentially bid for him, and they either had other options or they decided not to bid for Bautista. Do you think that those decisions that other teams made were informed by off-field questions like the draft pick and, you know, potentially even his personality, or is there some other on-field element that I'm not considering here?
No, so I think the draft pick had probably a little bit to do with it. This is, teams have become very protective of draft choices, and if you're not going to give a player a long-term deal, if you're looking at a one-year deal and you value this draft pick at like $10 million and you say, okay, Bautista's going to cost us $20 and then we have to give up a $10 million draft pick, that's $30 million for 1 year. Maybe he's not worth that, and you can talk yourself out of it. I do think probably the personality and kind of the fact that he alienated some teams that are in the market for that kind of player probably hurt him. I mean, I think if Jose Bautista was a low-key guy who never flipped his bat and kept his mouth quiet and wasn't on Twitter, the Orioles and Rangers are probably interested in him. But, obviously can't go to Texas. That wouldn't go very well, considering who plays second base for them. And he has not endeared himself to the Orioles organization. So I think removing two suitors that had money when you're kind of a, you know, a guy who's probably limited to American League teams anyway, because you're going to need the DH occasionally. I think there were probably not a lot of National League teams interested. So you cut two American League teams off the potential bidding list, you're limiting your actions in some way. So I do think Bautista's personality and the fact that he's, you know, kind of embraced by Toronto fans for his personality made that the best fit.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. And the contract they ended up agreeing on is a pretty complex one, and it includes a $17 million mutual option for 2018, a $20 million vesting option for 2019. Is that just window dressing, or do you think there's any chance those get exercised? What's your take on those options?
Yeah, so generally what happens when teams put in mutual options is they're actually just there to help defer money. So what usually happens, we actually saw this with Dexter Fowler last year when he re-signed with the Cubs in a similar situation where the market had rejected him and he had to take a one-year deal with the team he was already with. He got an $8 million salary up front and then a $5 million buyout on a mutual option. It was basically the Cubs' way of giving him $13 million but spreading it across 2 years. So I think what I expected to hear was that, like, the Blue Jays were going to do something similar in order to save money in their budget, where they'd give him, you know, $10 million in salary and an $8 million buyout. But then that turned out to not be the case.
Yeah.
Getting $18 million in salary and a $500,000 buyout, I can't imagine that $500,000 really moved the needle all that much for the Blue Jays to where that would be why the mutual option was put in there. Because if you're saving $500,000 in 2017 budget, that's a rounding error considering the amount of money spent on baseball players at this point. So why the mutual option is there if it's not to defer money is kind of an interesting question. And then they added the vesting option if the mutual option is picked up. I do think this could potentially be a case where, like David Ortiz in Boston, basically just had a series of one-year deals where the teams kept deciding, okay, are we going to pick up your option? I wouldn't be terribly shocked if this was one of the cases, which doesn't happen very often, where a mutual option could get exercised, where maybe, you know, in September, the Blue Jays say, hey, look, you know, this has worked out well for us, but maybe you didn't have a good enough year where you think you're going to go get 3 or 4 years. Just pick up the mutual option, and then you kind of have your chance to give yourself a two-year deal because that second option is a vesting option. It gives him a chance to get two guaranteed years if he's had another down year. So I think Bautista's representatives probably put that in there as a chance to give him a fallback plan next year, but I think in general, mutual options are almost never exercised, and there's a 98% chance he'll just be a free agent again next year.
Yeah, agreed. And we'll get to do this all again a year from now.
Yeah.
You mentioned the amount of money that's spent on ball players, and definitely that's the case a lot of the time. But it's funny, it's in this market, especially for offensive players. I mean, you look at Bautista signing for 18.5. You look at a guy like Michael Saunders signing for $9 million, and yet, on the other hand, another former Blue Jay free agent, Brett Cecil, goes out and gets $30 million. I mean, what do you make of a market that seems to be rewarding relievers so much and almost penalizing sluggers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the game is changing in a lot of ways. And so I think the prices we've seen on relief pitching is a little bit of a reaction to what we saw in the postseason, where it's no longer that teams just want a dominant closer and then they'll find six guys from the minor league system to pitch the league minimum in front of the guy. When they get to October, they want 3 or 4 or 5 guys. They want to have the Andrew Millers and the Cody Allen. They want to have, you know, more than just Aroldis Chapman or Kenley Jansen. When you saw how Joe Maddon had to work, you know, John Lester in Game 7 of the World Series, or what the Dodgers had to do with Jansen because they only trusted him and Kershaw, I think teams are saying, hey, look, we want reliable middle guys. We want reliable 6th, 7th, 8th inning guys so that we don't have to tax our relievers, especially during the regular season when we don't, you know, we're not going to bring in Andrew Miller in the 4th inning in May. So I think the game shifted more towards bullpen depth, and with money, you know, being reallocated to relief pitchers, it has to come from somewhere, and kind of, you know, one-dimensional power hitters who don't run the bases and don't play defense and, you know, can't play multiple positions, those are guys who have been historically overpaid. And so I think we're essentially seeing the adjustment is teams have said, okay, we need money for relief pitching. Where's it going to come from? Well, this is the area that has historically provided a poor return on investment. This is where you get the Ryan Howard contracts and the Albert Pujols contracts, and some of the worst deals in baseball are these, you know, one-dimensional sluggers who were great and then decline. So I think teams are basically saying, this is the worst way we've invested our money historically. Let's take it from there, give it to, you know, kind of a new way of developing bullpens and running pitching staff. And in that sense, I think the market is telling sluggers like Batista, hey, you've been overpaid for, not you specifically, but your type of player has been overpaid for a really long time. You're going to have to adjust and accept the reality that you're going to be paid less going forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, along those lines, I was looking recently at the contracts for every team and trying to find the worst contracts that every team had in baseball. And I guess I went in expecting that I would find a lot more bad contracts than I actually did, because I looked at teams like the Rays or even the Phillies, yeah. You know, the Padres. There are a lot of teams in baseball right now that just don't have any bad contracts.
Yeah, but I think what we've seen is twofold, right? So, like, teams like that had some bad contracts. Like, Ryan Howard, you know, his contract expired last year, so he's off the books. The Padres got rid of Matt Kemp, who was a terrible contract, and they paid to get rid of him. So teams used to have bad contracts, which is one of the reasons why they're in rough shape and they're rebuilding now. But those are gone, and now they've kind of moved on with their rebuilding. But I think we've also seen, like, the economic growth of the sport has turned contracts that used to be looked at as, you know, boat anchors into not bad deals. Like, I think the Jason Worth one, kind of one of the great examples, right? When it was signed, 7 years, $126 million, everybody freaked out because, like, people thought Jason Worth was going to get, like, $40 or $50 million, and he got 2 to 3 times that. And the idea when it signed is, like, this is one of the worst contracts in baseball history. And then Jason Worth was, like, a pretty good player for the Nationals, and now $126 million gets you, you know, Jordan Zimmerman or something. Like, you know, it's not that significant a contract relative to the top tier players now, who are getting, you know, what Giancarlo Stanton got, $325 million. So I think what we've seen is the growth of baseball has really helped turn some of these contracts that looked bad 4 or 5 years ago into reasonable prices now, when you look at what you have to spend to get a Brett Cecil, or, you know, when you look at what, you know, even Mike Dunn, who's not even a very good reliever, getting $19 million. Like, oh yeah, talent's expensive now. Deals that were signed a while ago don't look so bad anymore.
Yeah, the Mike Dunn deal, definitely. I mean, I don't think that's a deal that the Rockies are necessarily going to love, maybe as soon as a few months from now, but that's a market that the Jays are probably going to be operating in when you look at their needs for the rest of the offseason, and guys like Jerry Blevins and Boone Logan are still out there. Do you think those guys are maybe available for a little bit less than that 19-over-3 term that Mike Dunn got?
Yeah, I would think so. I think Dunn probably charged the Rockies a premium because no pitcher wants to go to Colorado. There's probably a, hey, if you want me to pitch here and, you know, have a 6 ERA just because, you have to pay me for it. So I don't think the Dunn deal is going to be replicated around the league, because I think Colorado had to pay a little extra to get him. But I do think, you know, what, Mark Jepchinski got 2-11. You know, Junichi Suzawa got 2-12. Like, this is the price now for an adequate middle reliever with some issues. And, like, that's basically what Boone Logan and Jerry Blevins are. So I think you're not getting these guys in one-year deals. It's going to have to be two. And it's probably going to be about $10 to $15 million range, which, you know, a few years ago you used to be able to find any generic left-hander. You know, you'd be able to find them for $3 or $4 million and just be like, okay, you're going to go get left-handers out. But nowadays teams want deep bullpens, and so I think the price on guys like Logan and Blevins has gone up.
Yeah, when you look at the Jays offseason and where they go from here, I guess conventional wisdom would probably place left-handed relief pretty high on their list of needs. And of course they need a backup catcher too. Is that the way you look at it? Or would you say potentially, you know, a left field is an area for them to address? What do you look at as far as this team's remaining needs?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. I would say if I was Mark Shapiro, I would sit down and say, what do I really realistically expect from Steve Pierce this year? And what do I think I'm going to do with him? Because if I think he's going to play almost every day at first base, and he's going to be an above average producer in my lineup, then maybe I can go with Ezekiel Carrera in left field, and maybe I can, you know, punt that position offensively. But if I think Steve Pierce is a platoon guy who's going to get 250 at bats, I think he's not healthy enough to be an everyday guy, and so I'm going to be running out Justin Smoke in my lineup on a lot of days, then I think you need a left fielder, because at that point, I don't think you can say, okay, you know, we're going to have Smoke and Carrera in this offense. We've downgraded our defense a little bit. You know, we're getting a little bit older. We don't exactly know what we're going to get from Tulowitzki next year or Martin next year. We don't know what Devin Travis is going to be, and we don't necessarily have a lot of depth behind him. At that point, you've got, Kevin Pillar's already kind of an offensive zero in the lineup. I think you're running the risk of degrading the offense too much if it's Smoke and Carrera as everyday guys. I think they need to have a realistic expectation of what they're going to get from Pierce and how often he's going to play. I would think, you know, certainly you want a left-handed reliever. That's also the kind of thing that you can potentially trade for in midseason. Relievers are always available. It's harder to go get an everyday left fielder, And especially, you know, when we see like Batista's getting $18 million, there's guys out there who could play left field for the Blue Jays who would be an upgrade, who maybe you could get, you know, for $5-7 million. You're not going to be able to get a left-handed reliever for that. But I would probably prioritize left field over the bullpen, knowing that I can go get a reliever at a later point.
Yeah, it's a. I think they're right up against their payroll too, so it might end up being one or the other. When you look at last year and how they ended up fielding, they were best in the American League at converting batted balls into outs. And now they have Morales at DH. That forces other guys into the field. You got Batista, who's a year older, potentially even slower than he was last year. How do you assess this team defensively right now?
I mean, I think it's still an above-average defensive team. Pilar is spectacular, so anytime you have him in the field, that really helps. Martin is a great defensive catcher. Tulowitzki can still play shortstop. I think he's degrading a little bit, so you don't necessarily expect him to continue to be as good as he was in the past, but he can still play shortstop. You know, if they end up going with Carrera and Upton, that's a good defensive outfield or a good defensive corner spot. Not guys who can hit, but, you know, at least good defenders. So there are good defensive players here, but as you said, like, signing Morales means that Batista is going to have to play a lot of the outfield, and, you know, the arm might not ever come back, and the range is probably going, so he's probably going to be a liability in the field. You don't know what you're going to get from Travis. You don't know how healthy he's going to be. He's never been considered a plus defender anyway, so he could be a defensive liability. You know, I think there's some real questions here. I think this is an above-average defensive team, but it's probably not going to be as good as it was last year, and I think we're going to probably see that with guys like Marco Estrada and Jay Happ, who rely on their defenses to a large degree. They're probably going to take steps back, not necessarily because they're going to be worse, although they might be, but just because the players behind them are likely to not perform as well.
Right now, when I go to your projected full season standings on FanGraphs, I see Boston, Cleveland, Houston atop the American League divisions, and then that puts the Jays, Mariners, alongside teams like the Rangers in that wild card race. Not that, you know, that's necessarily the end of the offseason. There could be more moves, but at this point, that's how things are looking. Is that how you see the American League playoff contenders shaping up at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think to me, Boston, Cleveland, and Houston are a step above everybody else. I mean, I think the Jays are not that far behind. I probably would have the gap a little bit smaller than what our projections have, because I think I'm maybe a little bit higher on some of the Blue Jays injury-prone guys. Like, I think if Travis and Pierce and some of these guys can put together, you know, close to full seasons, then that really helps the Jays, and they've got some upside there. But I do think when you look at, you know, what Boston can do, especially adding Chris Sale, when you look at how good Cleveland is, and I think with Houston's young players and kind of their depth of talent, I think those three teams are the teams to beat in the American League. And then you've got a giant train wreck in the middle of, like, basically every other team in the American League is kind of in that 500 range. There's a lot of teams that are, you know, maybe the losers are 85 wins or something like that. But I think everybody else is kind of in that hanging around 500, hope for health, hope for things to go well. Hope we can find one more guy from our minor league system to step up and make an impact for us. And maybe we can get to, you know, 89, 90, 91. And that's kind of where the Blue Jays are at. They're probably a little bit ahead of everybody else, I think. Maybe them and Seattle are probably the two wild card favorites at this point. But, yeah, I mean, I think the Blue Jays are probably the fourth or fifth best team in the American League as it stands, you know, at the middle of January.
So before letting you go, I do want to get your sense on the Jays' overall offseason, because it's been a weird offseason. I definitely didn't see it unfolding this way. I don't think many people did, maybe including people in the Blue Jays front office didn't see it unfolding this way. So what do you make of it? Does this Batista signing salvage what was initially a pretty confusing winter for Toronto?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if the Blue Jays had gone with plan A, which was give Edwin Encarnacion $80 million over 4 years, and then, okay, that eats up a good chunk of our budget. Now we have to go replace two outfielders, and we have to do it essentially with the Morales money. So you flip it and you say, okay, what kind of outfielder can we get for, you know, 3 years and $33 million, or maybe a little bit less, because, you know, Encarnacion, you know, got $80 million. Maybe it would have been like 3 years and $25 million. You're not getting a very good player, a quality starting outfielder. That's what Gerardo Parra got, $327 last year. Parra is not a very good player. So I think if you would have ended up with Encarnacion at DH, a weak outfielder to replace Batista, and then probably in the same position where you're choosing between left field and bullpen and backup catcher. That's a worse offseason. That's a worse team going into 2017 than in the one with Morales and Batista. And I think from the long-term risk standpoint, you'd have Encarnacion for 4 years in his mid-30s declining at DH versus now you only have the one-year commitment to the old guy. So I think the Blue Jays offseason actually worked out better with Batista and Morales than it would have worked out with Encarnacion and whoever they got to sign the outfield. I think I would still say that they probably made a mistake rushing to sign Kendrys Morales. before seeing that the DH market basically collapsed. And I think if they would not have signed Morales so quickly, they probably could have gotten, you know, Chris Carter or someone not dramatically different, although they wanted the left-handed hitter. But you could have gotten someone who's not significantly worse than Morales for, you know, $7 or $8 million on a one-year deal. But I think that overall, ending up with Batista, you know, 118 essentially, is a better option than ending up with Encarnacion at 480.
Very reassuring for Blue Jays fans, I'm sure. Dave, thanks so much. We'll be reading you at FanGraphs and following you on Twitter at DCameronFG. Thanks for making the time.
Hey, thanks, Ben. It's always been enjoyable to talk to you.
Big thanks to Dave Cameron of FanGraphs for all of the insight. Also, a huge thank you to Shai Davidi for coming in studio to discuss the Jose Bautista contract with the Blue Jays. Hopefully, we'll be back soon with Arden Zwelling. Hopefully, he recovers and is back next to me in the studio before too long, and we can discuss the Blue Jays' next moves at that point. Until next time on At the Letters.